Hello and welcome to A Flat Pack History of Sweden, that podcast that takes you on a chronological journey through Swedish history in English. I'm Chris and I'm the Brit in our duo.
And I'm Elsa and I'm the Swede in our duo. We're the couple that have now done 100 regular episodes about Swedish history, which is just mind-boggling, really. I can't believe this is episode 100. It has taken us just over 4 years to get this far, with a few special episodes on the way as well, but it has been extremely fun, hasn't it?
It really has. We won't dwell on the achievement too much right now, but we will celebrate it in 2 weeks' time when we release our 10th special episode, which will be about a three-week period in 1973. But more on that next time, and I will have a sip of my beer to celebrate that this is the 100th episode.
And I will have a sip of my tea to celebrate.
Cheers.
Sip, sip.
Before we jump back into the history, just like last time, our Swedish phrase of the week comes courtesy of longtime listener and top Swedish phrase suggester Magnus. And I think it's quite poetic that he gives us this Swedish phrase in this 100th episode. And this one's a bit of a weird one. It's sätta på pottkanten, which translates to English as put on the edge of the potty.
Yeah, I agree, it's quite weird. But first, though, maybe some of our listeners aren't familiar with the word potty, or potta in Swedish. It's a bowl-shaped thing that little kids pee and poop in. Or I suppose, historically, before plumbing and flushing toilets became a thing, we all more or less used potties if we weren't able or couldn't be bothered to maybe just go to the outdoor lavatory.
I have no idea if that's the American word or not, if it's the British word for it.
Yeah?
Well, write in if you're an American listener and you do or don't use the word potty.
Anyway, att sätta på pottkanten, to put on the edge of the potty, means to put someone in a, for them, troubling or difficult situation. So you could say something like, in the debate, when the opposition leader asked about lowering speed limits, you could tell that the leader of the council wasn't prepared. It really satte dem på pottkanten. It really put them on the edge of the potty.
I like how this isn't an example from our work life that we normally use in these Swedish phrases. And I guess it makes sense because if you're sitting on the edge of a potty, that could be a difficult or troubling situation if you consider the risk of falling in. They have to be huge for you to actually fall in, maybe like slip in.
Yes, that's the origin of the phrase, but I haven't been able to find any sources to the history or etymology of the phrase. Either way, it is something you hear Swedish people say quite a lot to describe being put in a difficult or challenging position.
So let's move on and see if Gustav Vasa and his merry band of rebels from Dalarna are able to put King Christian on the edge of his potty.
Oh, good transition. Let's briefly recap what we covered last time round before heading on with the story. This week we're back in the 1500s, in the spring of 1521 to be precise. Gustav Vasa has just been elected supreme commander of all of Sweden by the rebelling peasants in Dalarna, and Sweden is boiling with resentment against King Christian after the merciless treatment he's shown the Swedes in the Stockholm bloodbath and the events that followed. As we talked about in the last episode, it's not just Gustav Vasa who's outraged by Christian's handling of Sweden, but rather uprisings have been breaking out in several parts of the country. In fact, they began in Småland, where local peasants were reacting very strongly against Christian's ban on peasants carrying arms. And of course, as always, he maybe was going to introduce new taxes, and that always sets the peasants off. These uprisings, even though they still lack any sense of national coordination, are slowly starting to merge into one revolt against the king and the Danes and the Germans that he's put in position of local power.
That means that even though this period we're in now is sometimes referred to as Gustav Vasa's uprising or even Gustav Vasa's War of Liberation, that's not entirely accurate because whilst he was an important figure, it's not like he organized it entirely himself, nor was he in sole command of a unified move, or that liberation was the reason why a lot of the peasants were fighting to begin with.
Exactly, it's much more diverse than that, and especially the term Gustav Vasa's War of Liberation, Gustav Vasa's Befrielsekrig in Swedish, is very much a product both of his own skillful use of propaganda in his own time and nationalistic historians depicting this period later on in history. Using that word very much pits Gustav Vasa as a hero attempting to liberate the country from the tyrant King Christian.
And it's been talked about a lot very recently as well, because last year was the 500th anniversary. So that term is still very much used today, even if some people don't necessarily totally agree with it.
True. It's questionable whether you can really talk about liberation, considering that Sweden was historically a part of the Kalmar Union, and all Christian had done, albeit violently, was to bring them back to that state. But Gustav Vasa did want to make it so that Sweden exclusively controlled her own fate and her own territory. Nonetheless, talking about liberation no doubt suited both Gustav Vasa's own plans for himself and the country, and then later on suited the 19th century historians who wanted to depict this as a crucial moment in our glorious past when Sweden rose up and became its own country.
Yeah, so in some ways it is independence because it is Sweden ruling themselves, but is leaving the Kalmar Union becoming independent because Sweden was a part of ruling itself during the Kalmar Union as well. It wasn't as if it was only Denmark making all the decisions, even though that did happen sometimes. Sweden still had a role to play in the Kalmar Union, so can you become independent if you're leaving something that you're also controlling? You can see arguments on both sides. Whatever you want to call it, Gustav Vasa did want a Sweden free from the Kalmar Union and have a Swede as king, with no power at all down in Copenhagen. So let's head back to Dalarna, where Gustav Vasa has been elected the commander of the rebellion. Because a rebellion is violent, they needed to make sure he stayed alive, and so to ensure his personal survival in combat and in battle, 16 young men are selected to be his bodyguard. And this is the beginning of Livgardet, the Swedish royal guard, which, minor spoilers, will serve as bodyguards for the Swedish monarch for the next 502 years, and counting, to the present day. They had 500 years of unbroken service to the Swedish monarchs when they celebrated their 500th anniversary in 2021, so it's actually 503 years and counting. Albeit, yeah, he isn't a monarch when they start defending him here, but the tradition of Livgardet as an entity begins here in 1521. And the story is very cool, and there was a big fuss about it when the 500th anniversary took place in 2021.
It is indeed very cool. In fact, let me read out a little section from the Chronicle where it mentions this, as it is some great old-timey Swedish. Där kommer honom till förnämligaste av alla socknar, både östre och västre Dalarna, samtyckte och korade honom till Sveriges rikes hövitsman, svoro honom edel lydno och hörsamhet, satte så till honom 16 smucke unge karar, där honom tjäna och på honom akta skulle. So in English that would be something like, there came the most prominent men to him from the parishes of both East and West Dalarna, who hailed and crowned him to be Sweden's supreme commander, swore an oath to him and selected 16 strong young men to serve and guard him.
I translated that, so any complaints, have a go at me. It is a good fun of Swedish as well, so it's a little bit of a weird one. In the late winter and early spring of 1521, the uprisings continued to spread. From Dalarna, where Gustav Vasa is now in control of the whole county and the important mining settlement of Falun, it spread to Värmland and Gästrikland. This means that Gävle in Gästrikland becomes the first proper town that joins the rebellion. Meanwhile, it rages on separately much further south, especially in the original hotbed of Småland. Because Småland is a border area between Sweden and Denmark at this point, it's an area that's been particularly hard hit by the last decades of conflict between the two powers, and now the locals have frankly had enough.
Several noblemen, who like Gustav himself, hadn't switched sides and joined Christian after he killed Sten Sture the Younger and defeated the last of the Swedish rebel forces back then, well, they now come out of the seclusion that they've kept themselves in to be safe, and they join Gustav's forces, bringing political, financial, and military support with them.
But even though it's going well, Gustav's far from convincing the whole country to join him. For example, the peasants in Hälsingland have received a letter from Archbishop Gustav Troller, who sings the new king's praises, and that makes them hesitant to join the rebellion. Here we see once again that although Swedish peasants might seem like they're rebelling all the time, they're actually relatively cautious. They don't tend to join in personally unless they can be convinced that they themselves and their local area will be directly affected or will have something to gain. Gustav sets off with his part of his force to go on a propaganda campaign in Hälsingland, and leaves most of his force, though, back in Dalarna. That's because the council that Christian has left in Sweden to govern the country is becoming more and more concerned about the rebellion, and they decide it's time to deal with the rebels in force.
They send an army north towards Dalarna. It's led by Henrik Slagehek, brother of Didrik Slagehek, a bishop from Denmark who Christian has put as one of his trusted people on the Swedish council. Brothers Henrik and Baron von Mehlen are also part of the council's army. We met Henrik in the last episode when, in his role as the commander of Västerås Castle, he was the one that sent out a group to find and kill Gustav. And his brother, Beren, will return later on in our story. Otherwise, the council's army is largely made up of Danish soldiers and some mercenaries from Germany, Scotland, and France. Gustav, on the other hand, has managed to recruit a small group of mercenary soldiers himself, and he's also gotten a commander from Livonia. But otherwise, his forces are entirely made up of peasants, commanded by mainly lower-ranking noblemen.
The council's army is intending to head to Västerås to reinforce the castle there, and by mid-April they've reached the village of Brunbäck. There they set up camp near where there's a ferry crossing across the Dalälven River, hence why the battle that's about to be fought there will be known as Slaget vid Brunbäcks färja, or the Battle by Brunbäcks Ferry, not the Battle of Brian Ferry. That would be a new sensation, to quote a Roxy Music song there.
This is where Gustav's forces catch up with the council's forces. From a vantage point at a higher altitude on the north side of the river, the peasants begin to rain arrows down on the council's army, forcing them to retreat. In fact, they're soon planning a full retreat. As it stands, the Danes' willingness to fight is rather limited. Their heart isn't in this at all. Whereas Gustav's forces, they've been psyched up for months to engage in proper battle.
But before the council's force has had time to pack up their camp, a section of Gustav's army has gone round and over the river to hit them in the rear. The council's force try to fight this off, but the attack from the Dalarna peasants is violent. This means that most of the council's forces are killed and many are also captured. Some manage to escape though, even throwing themselves into the river, which might have only proven to be a temporary relief considering this is April and the Dalälven River isn't exactly a toasty place to be swimming.
The spirits of the rebels are, of course, only heightened by this victory in the first proper battle of the rebellion, and Gustav himself is strengthened in his resolve to step up the fight. He sets his sights on Västerås, the real stronghold in the region. Whoever commands Västerås and the castle there holds the key to the route between the mining areas in Bergslagen and the trading on the coast, and particularly in Stockholm.
It's estimated that Gustav now commands some 15,000 men in his force, but that doesn't seem to be too likely, because that's a huge amount, and we haven't seen many, if any, battles reach this kind of number, so some historians think this is likely an exaggeration. Regardless of how many there actually are, on their way to Västerås, Gustav's army suffer their first real defeat in the town of Sherping. This is because one of Gustav's units has captured the town quite easily, and so on the 23rd of April, they're treating themselves to a drunken night on the town. When they've fallen asleep, the commander of Örebro Castle nearby has managed to rally quite a lot of the peasants in the area on his side, and he catches up with them and massacres the drunken soldiers loyal to Gustav. This is making the war a bit more complicated, as now some peasants are joining up with the local Danish and German commanders fighting for the Danish king. So it definitely isn't the case that everyone in Sweden is siding with Gustav.
Undeterred, and perhaps even unaware of the setback in Sherping, Gustav continues with his main force to Västerås. On the 29th of April, they attack the town, and once again we see a display of the superiority of peasant-style weapons, even over trained armies, that can sometimes happen. The council force that are based at the castle are unable to attack the wall of pikes that Gustav's peasants are protecting themselves with, whilst at the same time they let arrows rain down again, causing panic among the horse-mounted soldiers.
Nonetheless, it's not until after some pretty brutal hand-to-hand combat in the town centre that the council force gives up and Gustav can claim to have taken the town and castle. According to historian Ulf Sundberg's account of the revolt, uprising, war, rebellion, call it what you will, in 1521, Gustav Vasa's tactic as a military commander is characterised by this desire to try and strike everywhere at once, so to say, and consequently force his enemy to divide their resources. So we've seen already that Gustav is splitting up his forces quite often and handing over command of one section to another, often relatively low-ranking nobleman, and have them go off and hit a town or a castle whilst he continues somewhere else. It's in this manner that he continues throughout the rest of the spring and summer of 1521, as he or a subsection of his force takes Uppsala, Nyköping Castle, Stegerholm Castle, and Höringsholm Castle. So they're on a roll now and really sticking to this strategy Gustav has developed. Meanwhile, forces from Värmland and Dalsland, who are also loyal to Gustav, are now moving into Västergötland, where the powerful nobleman Ture Jonsson Treirosa has his seat of power. He's basically forced by the pressure of all the peasants around him who want him to join Gustav to do that and join to fight on Vasa's side as well.
And Gustav's propaganda campaign in Hälsingland is finally paying off, and they join in the fight too. They're the people who got a letter from Gustav Trolle and were thinking about joining the king's side, but they've now decided to go with Gustav. Down in Småland, the fighting rages on, and by July, the neighbouring county of Östergötland is also joining in, having initially been suspicious of the revolt. In fact, even the Bishop of Linköping in Östergötland, none other than our old friend Biskop Brask, remember the guy who got out of Stockholm's bloodbath by showing his famous note? Well, he now pledges allegiance to Gustav and the rebels as well, which is a relatively quick turnaround for this man who only just got away with his life last time by avoiding a bloodbath thanks to a note in his seal. Gustav is even so bold as to send a letter to the Archbishop, Gustav Trolle, asking if he wants to join in the rebellion too. Considering the role Torle played in the Stockholm bloodbath and his allegiance to King Christian, he must have been Gustav's arch enemy in so many ways. I mean, after all, he'd killed Gustav's dad. We don't know if the letter was sent in all seriousness, if Gustav thought that maybe it was better to have his enemy on his side, or if it was more of a mocking thing. What we do know is that Trolle replies by sending his armed troops from Stockholm to Uppsala, where Gustav has a key base by now. At first, Gustav doesn't want to believe the reports that the Archbishop is sending troops to fight him, but when he does, he orders his troops in Uppsala to basically give the Archbishop's force everything you've got. And yes, that force is soon forced to retreat back to Stockholm. So 1-0 Gustav, I guess, against Trolle.
Considering that more and more high-ranking people are now joining the rebellion, like Bishop Hans Brask, it's becoming more of a consolidated effort across the country. And so that means they decide it's time to actually have a proper meeting. Let's sort some things out, organise ourselves a bit, and maybe draw up some longer-term plans rather than just run around and try and kill everything we can.
Sounds like a very sensible thing to do, if you ask me. I mean, in my head, I picture that they book one of those, like, conference rooms, you know? And they get some post-it notes out and do a bit of brainstorming. And then they take a break for coffee. Like, you know, modern management-style conferences.
And I think Gustav Vasa would fit in very well with his 16th century haircut and moving some of these post-it notes around. This meeting is called a herramöte, and that would loosely translate as meeting of masters or lords. And we've had a few of these sorts of meetings before during the Middle Ages, and sometimes they were referred to as herramöte, sometimes as meetings of the estates, sometimes as council meetings, sometimes as recesses. There's all sorts of different combinations, but it's basically a meeting of powerful people. And it's basically when the estates, so that means the four estates of the noblemen, clergy, and representatives of the peasants and burghers, all meet up to discuss matters of state. This herramöte is held in Vadstena, and we know it begins on the 21st of August. We don't actually know how long it lasts, if it's a day, an hour, or a week, or when this election actually happens, but at some point during the meeting, they elect Gustav Vasa as regent of Sweden, as Riksföreståndare, and he's following in the Sturas' steps here at this point.
Following in some big, big steps there, the meeting in Vadstena and the election of Gustav as regent serves to finally unite the rebelling Swedish counties, who, yeah, like we said, up until now have sort of been fighting separate rebellions against local bailiffs and commanders, but they now properly merge into one rebellion against King Christian and what is seen as his foreign imposed rule of Sweden. The united Swedish force can from now on fight a more clearly defined war against the king with Gustav as their commander.
Yeah, because he's been the commander, but now he's actually a regent, and so that puts a little bit of a more long-term thinking. They're now putting Gustav as the person they want in charge after the revolt. He's leading the revolt and has been, but now they want him to be the leader after the revolt as well.
Immediately after the meeting in Vadstena, troops are deployed south to Småland and Västergötland. In September, troops are sent over to Finland to organize the people there against the king. And Gustav himself heads to his base in Uppsala to begin preparing a siege on Stockholm.
For the 752nd time in the last 20 episodes or so. Whilst this is all going on, the council that Christian set up to rule Sweden is starting to suffer from more and more internal disputes as the country falls apart around them. Bishop Didrik Slagerhek straight away tries to position himself as the strong man of the council, and he was the one that championed sending troops to take the fight to the rebels, which resulted in the defeat at the Battle of Brian Ferry's Ferry that we mentioned earlier. After the defeat in that battle, Slagerhek is increasingly unpopular with his other councillors, and with the king too, who decides to remove him from the council by actually making him Bishop of Lund. So that's a bit like promoting someone out of a bad position they hold by giving him a job back in Denmark and not in Sweden.
Now, jumping slightly ahead in time, but just so that we can finish Slagerhek's story, the Pope is still very angry with King Christian for having killed two bishops in Stockholm's bloodbath. To get the Pope off his back, Christian needs a scapegoat. And in deciding who that could be, he will eventually land on Slagerhek. Maybe the king thought that he was getting a bit annoying and he hadn't dealt with the Swedes very well, so he should suffer. But whatever the reason, the king massively throws Slagerhek under the papal bus and tells the Pope that, yeah, everything was his fault. Slagerhek was the one that said that the bishops should be executed. And as a result, Slagerhek himself is hanged on Gammeltorv Square in Copenhagen on the 24th of January, 1522.
That's what happens when you get run over by the Pope bus, the Pope-mobile bus. But I guess that's all to be expected if you're very loyal to a person whose nickname is the Tyrant. You're probably going to be living a bit of a dangerous life. The internal disputes in Christian's Swedish council don't end after they get rid of Slagerhek, though, and it's made worse by the fact they keep writing to Christian, telling him what a disaster it's all being, and they're asking for more military support, but they don't end up getting anything. Because even though Christian has this massive rebellion now breaking out all over Sweden, he doesn't come over because he doesn't really have any more troops or money to deal with it. He's just got to watch as Sweden goes up in flames.
Yeah, so the reason he doesn't send money or troops is because, exactly, well, he has neither to spare, despite the severity of the situation. King Christian is essentially broke, and the Danish people are incredibly tired of war. They've been at war on and off with Swedish rebels since the 1430s, 90 odd years by now, and it's really hard to rally any support for yet another go. And the country is essentially bankrupt. Now, you might be wondering why the king himself doesn't at least come over to Sweden. But that's because, well, he's not home. He's in the Netherlands.
You think this might be a poorly chosen time for the king to go on holiday to look at the tulips and buy a windmill or whatever he's doing over in the Netherlands, but that's actually not why he's there. We do know why he's there, and that's because he had big plans for this trading company to rival the Hanseatic League, which we talked about in the previous episode, and he's trying to maintain a trade alliance that he's got that's very important for him, and that's important for him because it's with the Netherlands, and he's really trying to make this work and bring in some much needed money. Another way to try and bring in this money was to get some and loan some from his brother-in-law, who's the Holy Roman Emperor, who's actually based in the Netherlands at the time, and this is Charles V.
Whilst the king is off trying to score a deal on a loan and continues to ghost the Swedish council, the council's internal dispute continues to grow, almost to the point of dissolution. Fearing Gustav's oncoming attack, the archbishop and another bishop who also sits on the council, well, they both flee from Stockholm. Actually, quite a lot of councillors and other clergy and noblemen who are loyal to the king, they begin to flee to Denmark, and some are caught and killed by rebel forces on the way.
When we start the year of 1522, Gustav and his now united force of Swedish rebels control pretty much all of the Swedish mainland at this point. Nonetheless, Finland and Gotland still remain under royal control, or Danish control, and even though they're surrounded, the vital castles in Stockholm, Kalmar and Elfsborg still hold out for the Danes. What these places have in common is that they can all be resupplied and accessed by the sea, and that's Gustav Vasa's main weakness. Because whilst he's managed to take control of the Swedish land, it's still very much Denmark and the king's men who control the waves.
Indeed. And Denmark has one key man to rule those waves, and that's none other than Søren Norby, the Danish admiral who has been fighting the Swedes and commanding fleets since the days of Sten Sture the Younger. He's skilled and he's experienced, so he and his fleet will put quite a stumbling block in Gustav's path.
It's funny saying since the days of Sten Sture the Younger, that was actually only 2 years previously. So, but it feels like it's been a long time, doesn't it? This, you know, all the fighting goes on for so long.
In early 1522, Christian finally sends a fleet, led by Norby himself, to Sweden, primarily to relieve the now besieged force in Stockholm. Because whilst Stockholm isn't quite a capital city yet, no one will truly control Sweden unless they control Stockholm.
Lacking a real fleet himself, Gustav can do nothing but watch as Søren resupplies and strengthens Stockholm, and then heads to Finland to do the same there, keeping that entire part of the country firmly under the king's control, despite Gustav's attempts to try and build up the rebellion there too. Vasa realizes that this could potentially go on forever. Christian and his fleet will be able to continue to supply the important castles like Stockholm and Kalmar via the sea, and they can keep cutting him off from Finland too. We've seen this in previous years. It's taken nearly decades to conquer some of these castles, particularly Kalmar Castle and Stockholm. It can take years and years and years if they have support from the sea. Unless he gets onto the water himself and starts fighting back there, Gustav Vasa will either never win or it will take so much time and so much money to do so. And that could mean that Christian could potentially solve his money problems by getting some help from the Holy Roman Emperor and launch a counterattack. Moreover, because his forces are almost entirely made up of peasants, he needs to relieve them every so often so they can go home and tend to their farms. And there's no telling if they will keep coming back in the long run. If, you know, after years and years and years, they might get tired of having to go to war every year.
So he needs a fleet. And a proper fleet this time, not some retrofitted merchant ships, which is what Sweden has been using so far in history when they've been fighting at sea. And who has a fleet of ships to spare? Along with some proper mercenary soldiers and sailors and all the necessary kit? Well, Lübeck, of course.
Good thing Gustav is already so pally with Lübeck after the time he spent there after he escaped captivity in Denmark. But in all honesty, Lübeck wouldn't just be helping a friend with this support. As a leading Hansa town and major trading hub on the Baltic Sea, they have a vested interest in not having the Scandinavian countries unite and get the Kalmar Union back up and running again, since that would make them a major rival to the Lübeck and Hansa domination of trade in the Baltic Sea, especially since that Christian has these grand plans for a proper trading company of his own and his powerful connections with the Dutch.
It's basically the same old story it's always been. Lübeck and the other Hansa towns are willing to support rebelling Swedes because they don't want a united Scandinavia, and they want the Swedes to trade their copper and iron ore through them. Moreover, Lübeck realizes that they've got a super strong negotiation position here. When Gustav turns to them in the spring of 1522, they know he's locked in a stalemate, and they're the only viable source he has to turn to for help. So they run a hard bargain. They offer Gustav the fleet he needs, but in return they want economic and trading benefits with Sweden that, as historian Lars Olof Larsson puts it, would essentially render the Swedish economy dependent on Lübeck for the foreseeable future.
Gustav agrees despite all of this, and on the 7th of June 1522, 13 ships from Lübeck carrying 900 foot soldiers and a smaller number of horse mounted soldiers arrive in Sweden in Söderköping. On board are also lots of new weapons, much needed salt for the Swedish market, and even hops for making beer. So Sweden has its first dedicated, purpose-built military fleet and even some beer. So what better reason to celebrate? And celebrate they do, because that's why the Swedish Armed Forces consider the 7th of June the birth of the Swedish Navy. So just like we've seen loads of times, it's in time for another 500-year anniversary. And this time it was June 2022 when the Swedish Navy celebrated its 500th anniversary. So happy birthday to them. Well, a bit delayed, but 2 years late. Celebration.
Søren Norby must have been quite surprised when he sends another fleet to relieve Stockholm in July 1522, commanded by one of his most trusted men, and they never come back. Because Gustav has right away sent his new fleet to Stockholm to block the city's access to the sea and attack any Danish vessels trying to enter. And he divides up his new German soldiers so that one half goes and reinforces the siege he's put on Stockholm, and the other one reinforces the siege on Kalmar.
Later in autumn, Norby himself tries to relieve Stockholm, only to face the new Swedish Blueback fleet. He realises he's outnumbered, and this could have actually very well spelt the end for the king's fleet. But surprisingly, the Lübeck commanders on board the Swedish fleet let Norby escape. Historians have speculated that since Lübeck had a lot to gain from all this instability, they didn't want to end it anytime soon, so they let the Danish fleet escape before it was completely destroyed. And we actually have an account from Norby himself describing what happened when he tried to reach Stockholm with his fleet and bring new supplies there. "Had I not managed to fight myself and my ships out, they would have taken both my life and that of other honourable fighters, just like they'd done to my servants, because there were well over 600 men on the ships that were captured first and taken aboard the enemy ships, where they were divided amongst themselves and kept imprisoned for a day. The next day they threw them, bound with hands and feet, overboard and into the sea, all whilst making great noises with flutes, drums and trumpets. They also fired their cannons against the men, so that their screams and shouts whilst they drowned would not be heard."
Oh, that's brutal.
That is pretty brutal. That's a bad way of executing your prisoners.
Now, Gustav is able to move his besieging forces even closer to Stockholm, and he also builds sort of pontoon bridges that cut the city off even further. In August, Lübeck actually declares war on Denmark properly. So now they're not just supplying the people who are rebelling against the king, they're actually actively at war with King Christian. This is a really big step.
But despite this, as the calendar turns over to 1523, not much has actually changed on the map the last few months. Gustav still holds the majority of the Swedish mainland, whilst the king's men are holding out in Stockholm, Elfsborg, Kalmar, and Finland. This is when Gustav Vasa decides to go on another offensive once and for all. Berend Monvelen has actually switched sides too by now. He was previously a commander on Christian's side just 20 minutes ago, but now he's joined Gustav, and he's leading an attack into Skåne and Blekinge, whilst Ture Jonsson Treyrusa attacks Norway. And both of these attacks are quite successful. The Swedes take Blekinge, but don't really bother to push the attack further down into Skåne, instead choosing to consolidate their successes and focus on Norway.
The attack on Norway is also relatively successful, with many Norwegians in the southern regions choosing to side with Gustav against the Danes. As the king's forces retreat, they burn Oslo, which effectively stops the Swedes from trying to push any further into the country, as they would have needed to use the city as a base for supply and recuperation. So they call a halt and consider themselves quite pleased with the fact that after the spring offensive, Blekinge and the Norwegian county of Viken are now in Swedish hands. Viken corresponds to what is today the Swedish county of Bohuslän and then up the Norwegian coastal areas south of Oslo.
Meanwhile, things have gone from bad to worse for King Christian. Not only are Gustav's Swedish forces now attacking Norway and Denmark, Lübeck's fleet is also launching coastal attacks on Denmark proper too. The fleet even threatens, but eventually fails, to take Copenhagen itself. So with enemies not just at the gate, but pretty much in the hallway, no money left, and a population sick of fighting, Christian decides it's time to gather his council.
Now, we're not a History of Denmark podcast, so there's a lot of things about Christian's reign that we've not gone into detail about, or won't go into detail, or even mention, because it's more sort of on the Danish side of history. But we encourage you to, if you're interested, look it up yourself. Just remember, if you Google, this is Christian II of Denmark, because there are about 8 million kings of Denmark called Christians. You can get them a bit confused.
Yeah, like his grandfather, Christian I, for example.
Yeah, that's true. So this is Christian II.
What we're not going to go into much detail about is Christian's domestic problems, so to say, down in Denmark. We just need to mention, though, that since he took over the throne of Denmark and Norway in 1513, he's been actively trying to reduce the power and influence, not just of the Danish nobility, but especially the Danish clergy, who'd gotten pretty powerful in the decades previously. So Christian brings about a new set of laws that are intended to limit and control their behaviour and scope for action. Not just that, but Christian is also the first Scandinavian ruler to begin flirting a bit with this newfangled religious idea called Protestantism, which obviously doesn't make him any more popular at all with the clergy, who are absolutely Catholic. He never goes as far as converting or anything like that, but he's certainly at least interested in it, and comes to more direct contact with it when he visits the Netherlands too, which was back in 1521.
Another thing that's perhaps worth mentioning about Christian, if nothing else because I think it's interesting, is that even though he was married to Isabella of Asturias, who no doubt outranked him, so to say, in royal terms, being from the famous Habsburg dynasty and the sister of the Holy Roman Emperor, the king was much more interested in his mistress, a woman called Dyvge Sigbrittsdatter. She was Norwegian, and they'd met when Christian, back when his dad was still alive and he was the crown prince, well, Christian was living in Norway and was sort of practice ruling that country before he took over the throne completely.
Now, it's far from unique or even unusual that kings have mistresses, or that they favour their relationship with their mistress over that with their wives. But what's interesting in this case is actually Christian's relationship to Dyvge's mother. She was called Sigbrit Willoms and came from a Dutch merchant family. To cut a long story short, she became so pally with the king that she became one of his closest advisors, and eventually she sort of became Denmark's Minister of Finance for a few years. The king appointed her controller of the Sound Dues, that tax that Denmark is levying on all the trading vessels passing through the Øresund Strait, and how they get the vast majority of their money from, and she formed her own little council around herself, rivaling the official council of the realm.
Oh, that's not something you see every day, is it? You know, a king appointing his mistress mum to deal with the finances. I bet that didn't help Christian becoming more popular in the eyes of the Danish clergy or noblemen or the council.
It absolutely did not. In fact, by the spring of 1523, Christian's position in Denmark has become untenable. And after seeing the mood of the council at this meeting he's called, he actually decides to jump before he's pushed, so to say. He knows a group of noblemen, especially those from Jutland, are now seriously threatening to overthrow him. So he up and leaves, heading for refuge in his wife's native Netherlands. Interestingly, he brings both his wife and kids and Sigrid Willems with him. His mistress, Dyvge, had actually died a few years earlier.
Like we said, the Danish nobility has been having issues with Christian for a while now, and were indeed actively planning for his replacement. So they've got a new king already lined up. And that new king is Christian's uncle, Duke Frederick of Holstein, whom the Danes elect king in March 1523, making him King Frederick I. So they've brought in yet another German to be king.
And another Duke of Holstein as well. So it's all going on in Danish history. This starts a very long tradition of a King Frederick succeeding a King Christian in Danish history, because until 1972, all Danish kings were alternately called Christian and Frederick. So it went Christian, Frederick, Christian, Frederick, Christian, Frederick for 450 years.
Yeah, it did. I never knew exactly when it started, but yeah, this is the point in history when it began.
This is what the Rex Factor were called, a Rex Fact.
Indeed.
And it makes for nice symmetry in the Danish list of sovereigns, I guess, but also very confusing because who knows the difference between Christian the 8th and Frederick the 8th or Christian the 7th and Christian the 9th. It must be very difficult for Danish school kids to remember who is who.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's confusing enough that Swedish history have so many Karls and Gustavs and Ingeborgs. It's nothing compared to Denmark with their Christian and Fredericks. Now, you said that the tradition stopped after 449 years in 1972, but that's not because they began calling the kings by new names in Denmark. They didn't all of a sudden have an Olof or a Brian.
Yeah, they didn't just get bored.
No, what happened was that in 1972, Denmark got a woman as the monarch, my personal favorite, Queen Margareta. I mean, they missed a trick not calling her Christina or Fredrika, but there you go. Margareta is a nice name.
But they did name her after the only other woman queen of Denmark, Margareta. So Margareta II she became.
And either way, Denmark is now back on track because Queen Margareta actually abdicated just a few months ago. So now there's a King Frederick on the throne of Denmark. And can you guess what his son, the crown prince, is called?
Margareta?
No, he is of course called Christian. But back to 1523's version of King Frederick. He and his council firmly agree that the whole recent debacle with Sweden, you know, the war, the bloodbath, the ongoing rebellion, none of that is reason enough to give up on the idea of the Kalmar Union. They still think they can patch things up and move on. So they approach the Swedes and ask if they shouldn't all sit down for a good old proper union meeting, end the fighting and get the old gang back together.
Not unsurprisingly whatsoever, considering that, you know, they've been fighting this bloody war of rebellion, not just for the last couple of years, but also on and off for the last 50 or 60 years, the Swedes reply with a very firm no. The Kalmar Union ship has sailed, it's gone. It's also sailed and then sunk, and there's nothing left to salvage. As we said, there's been decades of rebellions by the Swedes by now, and there's just no hope of going back. Plus, even though there might be a new guy on the Danish throne that says he's willing to start over and forgive everything, maybe he's not going to be as bad as Christian the Tyrant. He's very much still a Danish king and a foreigner, and the Swedes have had it now with foreign kings.
Sweden is emboldened in making this rejection thanks to the support they're getting from Lübeck. Because Lübeck says that not only will they keep supporting Sweden if they reject the union and become an independent country, but actually they will actively withdraw their support and turn against them if Sweden moves to rejoin the Kalmar Union. And here, once again, we see Lübeck's motivation for why they're supporting Sweden in the first place. They don't want to see a united Scandinavia that threatens their trade dominance.
So instead of taking up King Frederick's offer to sit down and talk, the Swedish forces go on the offensive, and during the spring they manage to kick out the few remaining foreign bailiffs and take control of the remaining Swedish castles, so that's Elfsborg, Kalmar and Stockholm. The only territory they don't manage to get control of is Gotland, and that's where Admiral Søren Norby is holding out.
And it's worth mentioning that the Swedes and Gustav Vasa are now also in control of Finland. So yeah, the only bit that they don't manage to get control of is Gotland.
Nevertheless, the Swedish council meets in Strängnäs on the 6th of June and elect Gustav Vasa King of Sweden. So they've upgraded him from Riksföreståndare and Regent and made him king, seeing as the country is now all but fully reconquered. Stockholm is the last place to fall, and it did this around the same time as the meeting takes place. And on Midsummer's Day, the 24th of June, so a few weeks later, Gustav makes his triumphal entry into the city, accompanied by a group of German knights. Because, you know, these were the guys who helped him onto the throne. They're going to make sure, absolutely, that they cash in on the rewards too. But more on that next time.
Yes, more on that another time, because Sweden has a new king, and the Kalmar Union is no more. The Nordic Union that, whilst fraught with problems and facing so many rebellions that I've now lost count, well, it has existed since 1397, and now it's a finished chapter in history. And whilst dividing history up into periods is always an inexact science, and it differs from place to place, this is also what most historians use to signpost the end of the Middle Ages in Sweden. It's also the beginning of early modern history and the start of, well, the rest of Swedish history. Quite fitting that it took us 100 episodes to get to this point.
Yeah, and this is actually the first time since 1364, so nearly 200 years, that Sweden has a Swedish king, a king born and raised in Sweden as the ruler of Sweden as an independent country. Because remember, all the Kalmar Union monarchs and all of those people, and before them, Albert of Mecklenburg, they were all either German or Danish. So it's been a long time coming, actually, when you think of it like this. And the election of Gustav Vasa, the people at the time see it as a big moment of change in Swedish history, and so much so that that's continued on into the modern day, and that's why Sweden celebrates its national day on the 6th of June, when Gustav Vasa was proclaimed King of Sweden, even though it actually hasn't been a holiday and a day off until very recently, actually, since the 21st century. But before we move on and see what kind of king Gustav Vasa will be and how Sweden will transition into the Renaissance and beyond, next time we're going to take a pause and take stock of what kind of country Sweden actually is in 1523. Because we've seen so many changes over the last 50, 60, 100 years or so. We feel we need one of those sort of like summary episodes and see what the country looks like now.
Exactly. We'll see what kind of place Gustav actually took over as king. So that's what we'll be talking about in the next regular episode. For now, we just have time to read out two lovely five-star reviews that we got recently. One is from Jim, who says, Åsa and Chris are friendly, wonderful, and knowledgeable hosts. They make history fun and accessible to all ages. The Swedish phrase of the week that opens each podcast gives us a glimpse into the Swedish culture. And thanks to Magnus for his suggestions. I almost forgot they sometimes include outtakes at the end, which are hilarious. So are the occasional tangents when they go off script. Tack så mycket.
Thank you so much, Jim. That was a great review. Love that you like the Swedish phrase of the week, and great that you even give a shout out to Magnus in the review. I think that's the first time he's mentioned in a review, and in the 100th episode of all the episodes as well. So yeah, tack så mycket, Jim, and tack så mycket, Magnus.
Yeah, definitely Magnus deserves a shout out for all his good phrase suggestions. How about you read out the next one, Chris?
This is Enjoyable Journey Through Scandinavian History. This show's co-hosts provide a fun and enjoyable overview of the history of Sweden, starting in the midst of prehistory and eventually going up to the modern era. Yeah, brackets. Yeah, we're sorry about that. It's taking time, but we'll definitely get there. They bring some levity even to the rather grim periods of history and always put things into their proper perspective. I also love their Swedish phrase of the week feature as someone who's trying to learn some Swedish on Duolingo. Thanks, Chris and Åsa. I look forward to future episodes. And that's History Law 85 from the American Apple Podcasts. Another shout out for the phrase of the week. So that's great.
Well, thank you so much for both those great reviews. If you want to help the podcast, you can always leave a review on whatever platform you listen to us on, or you can email us on flatpackhistorysweden@gmail.com.
And don't forget to follow us on our social media and check out our website, which we've mentioned probably about 100 times by now, so we don't need to read it out again. But just thank you once again for listening to this episode, the 99 previous episodes, and the 12 or so special episodes and tangent times before now. We really appreciate that you listen and the great feedback we get to, or if you're just a listener in the background, just sitting there and soaking up all this Swedish history knowledge. Thank you so much for listening.
And thank you to you, Chris, for being my co-host and co-producer.
Oh, thank you so much, also. That wasn't I wasn't expecting you to say thank you, but thank you too.
Tack så mycket. Hej då.
Hej då.
End the fighting and get the old bang gack. Get the old bang gack, fang bang.
That's going in at the end.